This morning we're looking at the first portion of John chapter 6. John chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for all these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed them to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So this is starting chapter 6, and just kind of a reminder of how the Gospel of John is put together. The Gospel of John is broken basically into two halves, and the borderline between the two halves is right around chapter 12, 13. And the first half is the so-called Book of Signs, where there's this series of 7 signs kind of demonstrating who Jesus is. This is one of, this feeding of the 5,000 is one of those signs. And chapter 6 is really kind of plays a pivotal role, is kind of a peak point in that first half, in the first half of the gospel. And for the last couple of weeks, I've been wondering, what am I going to do when I hit chapter 6? Because it's a long chapter, and there's really no part of it that you can leave out. And even just breaking it into the pieces, it's kind of obviously built in 4 pieces, but even breaking it into the pieces is hard because they are so tied together. You know, this passage is so tied with the monologue about the bread of life that's going to be coming up, and they're all actually tied into the end of the chapter where most of the people who follow Jesus walk away from him. And so today we're just going to take this piece, but we're going to be in chapter 6 for a couple weeks. The thing that really kind of stands out in chapter 6 and in this passage specifically is the disciples show up. The disciples begin to play a role. Up until this point, the disciples have been around, but they have not had any real role. They've kind of been part of the backdrop. Jesus is doing the miracles, Jesus is teaching, Jesus is acting, and you have the crowd standing there watching, and you have the disciples standing there watching. And the disciples have not been involved at all. And in this chapter, the disciples become part of the core of what is going on. The disciples here in today's passage are directly involved in what Jesus is doing, and then through the chapter they stay involved. In the next miracle where Jesus walks on the water, it's done exclusively for the disciples. No one else even witnesses it. And then there's this monologue to the crowd about the bread of life, but at the end of the chapter, where the whole chapter is going, it comes right back to the disciples again. When all the other followers leave, and Jesus says, "Are you guys going to leave too?" And you can hear them almost, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you know, almost with hopelessness in their voice saying, you can almost, what they say is, it's almost like, "We'd love to, frankly, you know, but where are we going to go? There's nowhere else to go because we're committed to you." And so in this passage, the disciples are really kind of show up. And it's clear that Jesus is intentionally bringing them into what it is that he's going to do. Okay? When the need first arises of all of these people who need to be fed, Jesus turns to them, right? And he asks this, on the face of it, ridiculous question. You know, what are we going to do? You know, this is Jesus who always can handle every situation that arises, that's been healing people. Remember, he's been doing lots of signs and miracles other than what's just been recorded. They've seen him just taking care of every problem that arises, walks into the temple and turns the place on its head. And then he turns to them and says, guys, what are we going to do? And then he lets them wrestle with it. He lets them kind of feel that burden for a minute. He lets them come up with their own ideas. He lets them kind of feel the weight of that before he starts to do anything. He wants them involved. He wants them to have that sense of, boy, something has to happen here. What can we do? He wants them to, you know, I don't like the modern terminology, own the responsibility, to own it. He wants them to own it, right? So he lets them kind of think about it, and they come up with their answers that aren't going to work, of course. But then when he actually starts to do the miracle, again, he's keeping them completely involved. He tells them to go out and tell the people to sit down, right? And you can say, well, you know, they couldn't hear him. No, Jesus was constantly preaching to enormous crowds. Jesus could have, you know, raised his voice and they would have all heard him. He has the disciples go out and have them sit down in groups. And then when it comes to breaking of the bread, he has the disciples take it out and distribute it. And then when it's time to collect the things afterwards, again, he has the disciples go out and do it. Everything he does here, he's choosing to make the disciples directly involved. He doesn't do it direct himself. He's not here engaging the people. He's engaging the disciples and having the disciples engage the people. Now, if you recall, it was just last week that Jesus was making the point that I do nothing of myself, right? He was speaking about his relationship with the Father. He was saying, the Father initiates, the Father does, what I see the Father doing, that I do, right? He was painting out how the Father is the one that takes initiative and does things, but how the Son becomes a part of and is included in what the Father's doing. And now we see the exact same thing happening, not between the Father and the Son, but between the Son and the disciples. He's the one that's acting, he's doing something, and he's bringing them into what it is that he's doing. Okay? So they're being given, and Jesus doesn't have to do this, he's choosing to. They're being given the opportunity to become part of what it is that Jesus is doing. And not just he's kind of making this opportunity available. This is what he wants. This is what he's pursuing. This is his desire. His desire is to have the disciples part of everything that it is that he's doing. He wants them to be involved, to be connected, because he wants them to share in the glory. In the same way that the Father involves the Son in everything he's doing. Remember, the Father shows everything he's doing to the Son because he wants the name of the Son to be honored. He wants that glory, his glory as the Father, to rest on the Son as well. The Father and the Son together want to bring the disciples, and of course we stand behind the disciples, bring them into that glory. Remember, looking ahead in the chapter of John, Jesus praying and saying, as the Father and I are one, so our oneness may be with them as well. He wants to bring the disciples into the same relationship with himself that he has with the Father, in terms of the work, but also in terms of the glory being shared. Jesus is going to be glorified. There's no question in Jesus' life as he goes about his ministry whether or not he will be glorified. He sees, just as clearly as he sees the cross in front of him, he sees the glory behind it. There's no question as to where Jesus is going. But it's not enough for him to simply know of the glory that's following. He wants the disciples with him. He wants them to share in that glory. He wants them to be in everything that he is going to be in. Okay? Now, kind of stop and think what that feels like. You know, when we talk about the glory of God bringing us, not sharing his glory with us as in like giving a piece of it away to us, but bringing us into his glory, that's interesting and exciting. But what does it first feel like for the disciples when Jesus brings them in? It's a burden. It's a problem. 5,000 people need to be fed, and Jesus turns to Philip and says, Philip, what are we going to do? What was Philip's reaction at that point? Right? He probably bristled. He was probably kind of annoyed. You know, that's your problem, right? That's your deal. And actually, in one of the other Gospels, incidentally, this is the only miracle, and I'm not sure if it's just the only miracle or if it's the only story, the only piece that's recorded in all four Gospels. In one of the other Gospels, one of the disciples responds, well, just send them away. They're not our problem, right? This isn't my problem. They didn't bring a lunch. They can walk home hungry, right? We thought ahead, or at least we have you with us, right? So there's, when Jesus first, you know, if we can say this, when Jesus first plops this over on Philip's shoulders, you know, the disciples were probably thinking, whoa, this isn't our problem. We're not up to that. We never signed on for this. I have enough issues of my own. Right? There probably was maybe even a little bit of rebellion. It actually reminds me of Moses, and a lot of scholars say that that John here is intentionally recounting this parallel to Numbers 11. In Numbers 11, that's when the people are crying out, grumbling and complaining that they don't have any meat, they're sick of the manna. What kind of God is this? And in the account of God dealing with the people, Moses starts grumbling and complaining as well. And Moses' grumbling and complaining isn't about the manna or the lack of water. He's grumbling and complaining that, why did you give me these people? Right? He's saying, they're not my problem. I wasn't born into a sheikh family. Right? I wasn't one of the heads of the tribes. I was even maybe there in Egypt had the position, but I walked away from that. Right? It's not my problem. Why did you, is what he says to God, why did you take them, their problems, and put them on my shoulder? I didn't ask for this. I have enough issues of my own. Right? At first sight, as God calls us into participating in his life or in participating in his work, which ultimately is participating in his glory, at first sight, that first reaction, it's going to look like God's giving me something that has nothing to do with me. God's putting somebody else's problems on my shoulders. I'm being given something that I shouldn't have to deal with. Right? What happens when something in your life pops up unexpectedly? You know, you have enough problems of your own, and then all of a sudden somebody else's issue gets plopped onto your plate. The first reaction we can always excuse, right? Because we're human. But then do you catch it? Do you stay in that place of, this isn't my problem, they can deal with it, I have my own issues? Or is it possible that what you're being presented with is an opportunity of Jesus saying, come, be a part of my work, and be a part of my life, be a part of my glory? So he's bringing the disciples in here. He's bringing them into his work. And specifically, I think he's bringing them into his work when they already have a clear idea of what that work is. Okay? As Jesus is inviting them into being a part of service, they've already been with him for at least a year, possibly more like a year and a half. Okay? Because John, several times through the gospel, has already said, sometime later. So we're not at the beginning of the narrative anymore. And specifically when it says that the Passover was near, that means that they've been with Jesus for at least a year, probably more like a year and a half. This is most likely the Passover that's 2 years from the Passover when he dies. Possibly only 1 year away, in which case they've been with Jesus for even longer. Okay? So they've been with him daily for over a year. They've seen how he lives. They've seen his attitude towards people's needs. They've seen him day after day after day encountering mobs of needy people and always, always being able to see past the inconveniences of the immediate situation, seeing people, seeing their needs, and seeing what can be done. Not what he has to do, because he doesn't have to do anything, but seeing what can be done to simply meet their need and love them where they are and present the love and the interest and the mercy, the grace, the condescension of God. So the disciples have seen the way that Jesus is living, and as he's now calling them in to sharing that life, they have a clear idea of what it is to just serve. The cherubim. kind of an illustration of this aspect of God's nature, to just serve. Do you remember the cherubim that are pictured in Ezekiel, also in Isaiah, and then also in Revelation? Just kind of slightly aside, they're pictured sometimes differently, sometimes four wings, sometimes six wings, sometimes with four different faces, each of them, sometimes in Revelation, where each of them only had one face, but there were four different faces. Don't get caught up with whether those are different creatures or the same creatures and why there could be differences. Those creatures don't actually have wings. They don't actually have eyes. They don't actually have faces. They're spirits. And as Ezekiel has a vision, or Isaiah has a vision, or as John has a vision, the Lord can reveal them symbolically differently. It's clear that they're the same four cherubim in all of those cases. But if you recall correctly, the four faces are the lion, ox, man, and an eagle. And if you read any introduction to kind of biblical interpretation or anything, you'll always see the connection to the four Gospels. And don't just take that to mean the four cherubim symbolize the four Gospels, because that's not what's going on. The four cherubim are symbolizing characteristics of God. They're four aspects of God's personality, just as the Gospels are reflecting different aspects of God's personality. It's not that the four cherubim relate to the four Gospels. The cherubim relate to the character of God, and the Gospels relate to the character of God. Okay? So these four faces, you could say, four faces of God. One of them is the ox, right? Which the ox, it's not speaking of Luke's gospel. The ox is speaking about God's characteristic, that God is strength, but that particularly God is strength that's focused on service. Okay? The ox is one of the strongest of animals, but it's an animal that's domesticated. God is domesticated. No, right? But the ox is that strength that's in service. The ox doesn't serve itself with its strength. The ox doesn't really do much of anything for itself, right? And that strength is available, and man benefits from that strength, okay? In contrast to the strength of the lion, a couple of months ago, there was a National Geographic article about lions. Who saw that? Yeah, fabulous, unbelievable pictures. Oh, come on, you guys. No? Rachel, why aren't you putting your hand up? You saw that article. So anyways, it is detailing a little bit about the sociology of lion prides and how they interact. And it's awful. Oh, my goodness. It is unbelievable. Just lions are so selfish. Like, the strength of the lion is all about the lion. Particularly, you see the way that the males interact with the females and the young and stuff. I mean, the males do nothing. And the females drag home something to eat, and the male comes over and chases everybody off, eats as much as he wants, goes back to sleep. I mean, not what you want to take your not yet. Where's Craig's already getting ideas? Yeah. Not an image of godly manhood, right? So, anyways, I mean that's strength. But of course, the lion is speaking about majesty and stuff. But the ox is also, in contrast, the ox, it's strength that's all about service. Right? And Jesus is inviting the disciples to become part of that service that's just pouring itself, taking care of others, is always focused on taking care of others. Service, service, service. And not service that's just some kind of portion of its life. Right? And that's what the disciples had already seen in Jesus' life. That his service was all the time. That there was never a time when he had to back off and not be available. He was 100% available all the time. But then particularly, what Jesus is doing with the bread would have spoken deeply to the disciples. Not at the moment when this happens, okay? But later. The disciples later in life, looking back on these events, and us, because we're in that position, looking back on these events, we can see the significance in what Jesus actually does with the bread. And it's important to remember that when the gospel writers wrote the gospels, they were not writing the gospels from the perspective of, this just happened, this isn't a diary recording events. They're recording events from the point of view of much later in life, looking back at them and understanding the significance. So just as John is writing this passage from a point of view of having lived and experienced and preached and taught and reflected upon these events for 60 years,
In the same way, we can also look back at them already knowing what happens later in the gospel and see things that the disciples may not have seen that day, but certainly understood later. And particularly when Jesus takes that bread and breaks it and passes it out, not that day, but later, reflecting on it, the disciples would have understood that Jesus that day is not only just the servant, just taking care of people, meeting their needs, taking this bread from here and bringing it over, meeting the need, but that he himself was that bread and that he himself was broken. That yes, Jesus met the needs of the people, but specifically he met the needs of the people with his own substance. That he not only was available to serve, but that he laid his life down. That it's not just about service, but that it's about being yourself broken and passed out. And so Jesus is here, although the disciples couldn't have understood it on that day. He's inviting them not only to imitate his life of continual service, but he's inviting them to come and die as he dies. He's inviting them to come and be a part of his sacrifice of himself. Coming back to the ox was not only the animal that got all the work done on the farm, it was also one of the sacrificial animals. And there's a Roman coin. Has anyone ever heard the ox Roman coin sermon illustration? If you go online, everybody uses it. I didn't think this up. Everybody, this is one of the big popular ones. They say that there was this Roman coin that had a picture of an ox, and it was standing between, on one side, a plow, and on the other side, an altar. And the inscription on the coin was, "Ready for either." And actually, I did a little bit of research, and I looked at some Roman coin catalogs, and I couldn't actually find the real coin anywhere, so it's possible that some preacher long ago made this up. I don't know. Maybe there was a real coin. In either case, it's a really great illustration of what we're talking about here, that ox is simply ready. Its attitude is simply availability, whether that's today to go and to serve and serve and serve, or whether that's today in some way just to die. Okay? There are these two levels of what Jesus is inviting the disciples into. He's inviting them to come and to serve, to have a life of serving others, to constantly, day by day by day, to meet the needs that are around you. But he's also, at a deeper level, saying, if you're going to do that, you're coming to follow me, to be my disciple, ultimately, it will mean that God is going to take you in his hands. And rather than to take that loaf of bread and go and tuck it behind the throne, when God takes you in his hand, he's not just going to protect you, although he's going to protect you. He's going to take you, and he's going to break you. He's going to take your life, but then what he wants to do with it is to tear it apart, to tear it into little pieces and pass it out to people that their needs will be met. That yes, you, by coming and following me, I'm going to include you in serving others, but the particular way that that's going to happen is you are going to be serving them with your very own life itself. That in this process of meeting other people's needs, you yourself will be broken down. You will lose your life, and others will gain life by it. He's inviting them into the fullness of his own life. Because Jesus himself is daily meeting the needs of others. He's serving, but that's all only leading up to the point when he really lays his life down and dies in the place, and by his very death, by his losing life, others come and have the life. But the point where the coin illustration falls apart, and every illustration eventually falls apart, is that it presents this as a dichotomy. The ox is standing and he goes either one way or the other, either to service or to sacrifice. And in the Christian life, it's not a dichotomy. It's not an either or. It's a both and. And this is unfortunately where a lot of people are. A lot of people are trying to serve. A lot of people are trying to do good work. A lot of people are trying to live a Christ-like life. A lot of people are out there trying to take care of other people without having become a sacrifice first. And it doesn't work. A lot of people, and there may be some people here who have already been through this. There may be people who are in this now. There may be people who are thinking about going into this, of trying to live for others. But if you go out there and you simply try to live for others, if you just understand what it is to be selfless and you just go out and try and be selfless, try and always be available, try to not turn anybody down, try to be the one that can always be dependable and meet somebody else's needs, it's only a matter of time before you will get sick of it. It's only a matter of time before one day you're going to wake up and you're just going to be tired out. And somebody's going to come along and they're going to have that need and you're going to explode at them. You can't serve others if there hasn't already been that identification with Jesus Christ in his death. You can occasionally, you can to a certain point, you can take some of the excess and pass it along, kind of meeting your own needs, and then, you know, what's left over, taking care of others. That you can do. But that's not the life of Jesus Christ. That's not how he lived. It's only possible, the only way that it is possible to actually live a life of continual service, where you are simply available to meet the need of the person who pops up in front of you. The only way to live that life is to have already settled once and for all and repeated every day that I am dead to the world, crucified with Christ, that all I have and all I want is you. Right? That's how Jesus lived. But it's not only how Jesus lived. You know, there's sometimes a mistake or this problem that it's hard for us sometimes to take Jesus as an example because he was the Son of God. And you hear people say that. You know, somebody will describe how Jesus lived, and someone will say, yeah, well, he was Jesus. I've heard pastors say that, and it really kind of shocks me because to me it just goes right to the core of what the incarnation was about. You know, in a round table or something, you'll paint a picture of the Christ-like life that somebody calls us to, and somebody will say, yeah, but he was the Son of God. He didn't have the issues that we have. No, he did. But you know what? Even if we get tripped up on that and we don't think that Jesus can really be our example, then there's always Paul. You look at the life that Paul led. You look at the way that he served. You know, we look at Jesus and we think, walking around, no place to sleep, never knows what he's going to have to eat, nothing to his name. The life that Jesus led, he led for 3.5 years. Paul did it for over 30 years. Just serving, nothing for himself. Always simply available to meet whatever need it is that comes along. And why can Paul do that? Why does he have the energy? Why does he have the strength? Why does he have the availability? Why doesn't he have finally at one point just get up and slam the Bible and say, enough! You guys take care of yourself when they don't want to listen. He never gets to that point because he's already learned, he already knows what it means to I die daily. Paul has already been here. He's been to the cross. He's been down on his face. He's seen that his life is over and he doesn't want it back. And because that has been settled, and I'm sure at times he was tempted to try and take it back, but because he had really settled it, and because I think every day he just reaffirmed that all I want is Jesus and his glory. And he knows what Jesus' glory looked like in this upside down backwards world. It looks like the cross. And so when every opportunity of some needy person popped up, Paul doesn't see the needy person. Oh, I'm a churchgoer. I have to take care of this one too. Right? He sees the person in need, and he sees God's love, and he's ready to meet that. But over and above that, he sees the cross rising up that he has devoted his life to, knowing that the cross that crucifies him is actually the source of glory. And he sees conformity to the Lord Jesus Christ, which is what he has set his heart on. And that can be our reality. That can be our reality. If we settle it with God, that we want nothing except Jesus Christ and his glory. Have you ever said that? Have you ever taken the time and specifically, and don't get by with, oh yeah, yeah, that's what I think. Have you ever said it? Have you ever said out loud, gone to your bedroom, gone to the bathroom, gone out in the backyard, gone down in the cellar, and said out loud, Heavenly Father, I look across all my life, and what I want is Jesus Christ and his glory in this life and in the life to come. Make that decision. Count the cost. look at everything in your life that he perchance might touch and say that he can do it. And then when you go out in your life, make sure that that's the point from which you are living day by day. The Lord Jesus Christ, when he gets later on in the gospel, again, I'm not sure if it's this gospel or another gospel, there comes a time when the cross is really coming up close. The cross is looming large, and the disciples are beginning to get it. The disciples are beginning to understand that Jesus is going to die and that he's intentionally going there. He's not being corralled in, that he's, for the last 3 years, has been walking straight line, straight to his very own death. The disciples are beginning to get it. And Jesus says to them, he says, now my soul is troubled. But he's not just opening up to them, guys, I'm really struggling. He's making a point to them. He's saying, now my soul is troubled. You guys don't even have a clue what I am going through. But what am I going to say? He says, in this place where I am right now, struggling, fearful, torn apart, what am I going to say? Am I going to turn and say, Father, deliver me from this hour? He says, no, because this is the whole reason that I've come to this point. As Jesus is closing in on the cross, there's not that reaction of, oh, wait a minute, where'd this come from? I never signed up for this. Lord, deliver me. I want to go back to the miracles. I want to go back to being the traveling preacher. No, because he understands that all of that, that this is where it all becomes significant. That without this point of finally going through and dying, all of it is meaningless. How do we react when these unexpected things pop up? What's your response when you're just cruising along, your day's going fine, and then the cross rises up before you? Whatever its form might be. A surprise diagnosis. A person who disrupts your day. And any of the other million disruptions that can happen, from the little ones to the big ones. Because we're people, usually that very first response is rebellion. Wait a minute, this isn't my problem. This wasn't part of the plan. This isn't what I signed up for. This isn't what I thought. But then after that immediate natural response, does the mind, does the spirit, does the longing for the glory of Christ kick in and say, wait a minute, I recognize this. And I recognize the rebellion of the flesh. I recognize this. This is the cross. This is the reality of what I prayed this morning. I'm going to embrace it. Or is the reaction, oh, Father, deliver me from this hour. And we back off and want nothing to do with it. That disruption, that cross, whatever that is that rises up, that opportunity to lay your life down, and which is most often an opportunity to serve another person, that's the very reason for which you've been brought to this hour. Why? Because it's so important to serve people? No, because it's the way that we encounter the cross, which is the way to glory. It's where the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ is. Now, in contrast to here, what Jesus is doing with the disciples, drawing them into his life of service, his life of dying to self, his life of glory. And remember, this whole thing is only happening because Jesus wants them to be part of his glory. It's driven by his love for them. His desire to not want to come. Well, that's redundant. His desire to not want to come. His desire to not want to come to glory without them. Do you remember, it speaks at one point of God the Father's love, who wouldn't even answer give the promises to the fathers because he didn't want them to come to glory without us. It's all driven by God's love. Jesus doesn't want to even come to glory without the disciples, so he's drawing them into his life here. That in contrast to that, we also have the crowd. What's the crowd's response to this whole thing that's going on? A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the whole bread and circus phenomenon, right? That Jesus is doing these miracles, and the crowd's delighted, right? Hey! Well, here we have the other half. Then was the circus, right, in the cleansing of the temple and the healing of the man's son, that Jesus didn't give them the circus with the official from Capernaum who came to Cana. Right, well, now we have the bread portion of it. Right, the people, they want their needs met, and they want to be entertained. And they don't want to get too close. They want to stand in the crowd, be fed and entertained. But they're not going to get close to Jesus. He's dangerous. And what's Jesus, well, and it really comes through in their response at the very end of the passage. In Rome, the bread and circus phenomenon. Again, it wasn't an official policy of Rome. It was something that people who wanted to get elected just kind of did on their own. And that's where it figured into the system. People who wanted to be in public office would pour huge amounts of their own money into free distributions of food and in putting on games. Right? Games weren't done on the public budget the way the Olympics are now or whatever. They were the games in the Roman culture were put on by rich people who wanted to be in public office because they knew they could make it back many times more over. So a rich guy comes into Rome or in some other colony, feeds all the people, puts on big chariot races, brings in the gladiators, brings in the wild animals, and what's the people's response? Hey, this is excellent. We got to put that guy in charge. Right? And that's exactly what happens here. Jesus comes in, he feeds the people, he's entertaining, and their response is, let's put that guy in charge. This must be the prophet. You know, some of the wackos, the right-wing extremists, were talking about John the Baptist being the prophet, but that was kind of scary, wasn't it? Yeah. Now this guy, this matches up. This is a guy that I could say, yeah, let him be the prophet. And they actually were ready to come and take him by force and make him king. And Jesus' response to it is that he'll have nothing to do with it. He walks away. And if you recall, we've already had two situations I've tried to bring out in the gospel earlier where Jesus will have nothing to do with them, where he turns away from them, when he walks away from them. The first was back at the cleansing of the temple when it says that the people believed in him, but in reality we know that they didn't put their faith in him. They believed that he could do something, but they kept their distance. Yeah, take somebody across the falls in a wheelbarrow. I'm not getting in, right? And what was Jesus' response? It said he didn't entrust himself to them. That passage, I know I spoke about it that other week, but that line always bothered me. Jesus would not entrust himself to them. But then we saw the same thing when he came back to Galilee. And, you know, the man came to have his son healed and the crowds got excited and Jesus wouldn't do it. He wouldn't give them the miracle. He healed the man's son, but he wouldn't give them the spectacle that they wanted to see. And he rebuked them. He was speaking ostensibly to the royal official, but he was speaking to the crowd. That I will have nothing to do with the kind of faith that you have. The way that you believe in me, I won't have anything to do with. Right? He put his hand up. He kept them at a distance. And that's what we see here too. With their excitement over the miracle worker being around, their desire to have their needs met, Jesus puts the arm up. And he turns his back on them and he walks away. And we don't like to think about that, right? We like to quote that whoever comes, Jesus receives them. He won't turn anyone away. Keep that verse in its proper context. I did a lousy job quoting it, right? But Jesus is doing that here. The way that the people want to believe in him, the way that they want to put their faith in him, they're dictating the conditions. He will have nothing to do with it. He turns their back on them. He keeps them at arm's length and he walks away from them. Later, in the same, again, I'm not entirely sure, same gospel, we'll get there, or the other gospels, but we know later in the story, Jesus at one point removes his outer clothes, dons a towel, wraps a towel around himself, and serves his disciples, washing their feet. Humbles himself, lowers himself, meets their needs at his own expense. Right? We see that happen. If you open your eyes, you'll see that daily, of God lowering himself to meet your needs. And keep in mind that when God meets your needs, he's lowering himself. He's humbling himself. He is condescending. Whether he's meeting it miraculously, whether he's meeting it unexpectedly, whether he's meeting it through the operation of the church. When the church reaches out to you, when you're in a hard place and you get a card from somebody at the church, somebody brings you a meal, as long as you keep it all at the horizontal, my brother and I level, it's all, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. It's communism. Right? When you keep in mind that meal that somebody brings to you, yes, somebody's doing for you what you would do for them, but in that, God is condescending to take care of you. And when we see God humbling himself, condescending, lowering himself to take care of us, we have two possible reactions. The first reaction is that we can react the way that the crowd did. Hey, excellent. This is good. I can love that kind of a God. And you know, while you're at it, I have this bill, and I have this problem, and my brother doesn't get along with me, and, you know, I'm going to be careful here. You'll think I'm being autobiographical. one trick to not be autobiographical is you always switch the genders, you know, and fix my husband. So one attitude is to say, awesome, I like this kind of a God. Here's the list. Serve me. But you know what? That's the response that Jesus turns around and walks away. And again, we don't like to think about that. We don't like to think that someday grace might end. But you know what? He does this. And this is why we have so many people out in the world who came into the church, saw these good people, saw these programs that take care of people. They got excited. They had a meal brought to them. Somebody visited them. They got a check to pay for something. They're excited. They're like, wow. And then at some point, things got tough in their life, and they got offended. They got bitter, and they turned and they walked away. You've met those people. You know those people who aren't in the church because they were disappointed with God. They were disappointed with the church. Because they thought it was all going to be bread and circuses. They thought it was going to be show up, raise your hands, hop up and down, and people take care of you. And then it got to the point where, no, you're expected to put yourself in God's hands, understanding that He's going to rip you apart and feed others. And they left, not realizing when they left, Jesus was turning His back on them. Will He take them again? Absolutely, and of course. But as long as they're dictating to Him that you're going to be my God, you're going to meet my needs, I'm going to say how happy I am with you. He says, no, I'm going to have nothing to do with that kind of a faith. The other response that we can have as we see God condescending to meet our needs and take care of us is the response of Paul, the response of the disciples, the response that I know a lot of us long to see more of in our own lives. And it's the Romans 12:1 response. And I'm going to not quote it, but I'm going to get the sense of it right. Looking at all of these things, right? And there at Romans 12, Paul's looking back over everything he's been talking about in Romans, particularly up until the beginning of chapter 9. Looking at chapter 5. I hope as I name these chapters, you have a sense of what's in them. Looking at what God does for us, well, 1 through 4. Looking at what God does for us in chapter 5. Looking at chapter 6. Looking at chapter 7. Looking at unbelievable chapter 8. And saying, looking at what God has done for us. How can you have any response than other wholeheartedly throwing yourself on the altar as a living sacrifice for Him to do with as He pleases? Seeing that Jesus has made Himself entirely available for you, anything short of making yourself entirely available for Him is unworthy. Anything other than that is unpleasing. Anything other than that is illogical. If you look at the word that Paul uses there in Romans 12:1, for our reasonable, all the different translations translate it differently because it's such a difficult word, and it means all of these things. That kind of response, Jesus gave all for me, so I give all for Him, that is reasonable, that is appropriate, that is logical, that is spiritual, that is rational. That is the proper response to Him. And anything else falls short. As we see God condescending to meet our needs, and then we have to recognize that He is calling us into that very same life that pours itself for others. And what's the end result of it? It's not just being broken. It's not just saying, well, I lose my life, but look at all the fruit of it. No, it's glory. It's resurrection. It's an eternal life of enjoying the fruit of that. It's having your life torn apart to feed others, seeing others raised up to life because of your death, and then yourself being raised to life to enjoy fellowship with those who have been raised up. It's after the pattern of Jesus Christ Himself. Does Jesus regret going to the cross? Does it still hurt? Or is it all glory? As He's calling us into the service, and as He's calling us into the sacrifice, in fact, what He's doing is He's calling us into the glory, both here in this life and in the life to come. Do you want to experience the glory of God? Does your heart cry out with Moses, Lord, show me your glory. This is the glory. And in a daily life, You know, once in a while, once in a great, great while, there's a Jim Elliot moment, and there's a spear, and the sacrifice is death. But the problem is that when we lay down our life for Jesus Christ, it doesn't happen all at once. He wants us to lay down our life penny by penny through the course of the day, with one annoying person after another annoying person, after another disruptive event, after another disappointment, after another frustration. We have that spiritual high and we whip out our wallet and we want to give Jesus the whole $100 bill, and he gives it back to us and says, no, give me a dime a day. And that's harder for us. But that is what it is to walk with Jesus. And the result is that you find yourself living in his life, enjoying the glory of his life. Amen.